Washington's police chief warns of a major security threat as more than 20,000 armed troops are being mobilized ahead of Joe Biden's presidential inauguration. The Pentagon warns that far-right and white supremacist extremists are actively recruiting in the U.S. military and have gained more support over the past year. And the UN World Food Program warns U.S. designation of Yemen's Ansarullah movement will be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, the U.S. is beefing up security in the capital, Washington, D.C., and states across the country in the wake of Joe Biden's presidential inauguration for January 20th. 20,000 National Guards were deployed to Washington after the FBI warned of a major security threat. For more on that, we're joined by our guest now in our news review program. The capital of the U.S. is beefing up security ahead of the presidential inauguration of Joe Biden. City center of Washington, D.C. is under lockdown with more than 20,000 armed National Guards deployed. And Washington Police Chief Robert Conti said U.S. Capitol is facing a major security threat 1 week after supporters of the outgoing President Donald Trump stormed the Capitol. The state Capitol buildings across the country are also on high alert after the FBI warned earlier this week of armed protests being planned in Washington and all 50 U.S. states. Heavy security measures will run until Biden's inauguration ceremony slated for January 20th. And joining us now for this news review is Wilmer Leone, columnist and political scientist, joining us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Wilmer. Pleasure to have you on. Happy New Year. Hope you're doing safe and you're well. We've seen some really unprecedented things in the last week or so in the U.S. Your thoughts on security when it comes to Joe Biden's inauguration in less than a week?
Oh, at this stage of the process, I don't really think that security is going to be an issue. We don't know what the protesters, the insurgents, the insurrectionists have planned, but I think things now have gotten to the point where the government's ready for whatever they've got.
And the siege last Wednesday on Capitol Hill, you know, there are certain news outlets that are saying that there is proof that they were planned, that it wasn't just, you know, people just converging on the Capitol, irate, feeling their vote was stolen, you know, stuff that was kind of like they got riled up by U.S. President Donald Trump, but that there was people with floor plans, with, you know, an exact agenda, and they were coordinated, and perhaps they were even coordinated, you know, via social media or their phones or whatnot to do exactly what they did and perhaps even more, and they fell short of actually possibly killing people in that building. So do you feel that there is going to be another coordinated effort to disrupt the inauguration? Or meanwhile, supposedly there's 50 different, states now worried that their capitals are going to see similar protests on inauguration day. Your concerns?
This was definitely an inside job. There's no question about that. The United States Capitol is one of, if not the most secure buildings in the world. And you don't just breach that fortress without, you don't just breach that fortress without air cover and an army. They were let in. They knew where they were going. They knew who they were looking for. They knew where those people were supposed to be. This was definitely an inside job, and the FBI has information to support that position. So I worked in the building, so I'm quite familiar with how secure the building is. And you don't get through those doors unchallenged and without rounds being fired. So this was definitely an inside job. There's definitely going to be a very huge lift needed by the state houses in the 50 states across the country. And it's not going to be pretty, but I don't think we're going to see another January 6th on the 20th of January.
All right, good stuff. Very optimistic there. Right now we're joined by Matthew Fogg, former chief deputy from the U.S. Marshal Service, joining us also from Washington, D.C. Hello, Marshal Fogg. Now, Marshal, I have to ask you this question. How concerned are you that, you know, we're going to lead up to this in less than a week's time, Joe Biden's inauguration. Do you feel it's going to be a heavy burden, and do you feel U.S. law enforcement will be overwhelmed to provide security in the next week or so?
Well, no. As far as security is concerned, this on the 20th, okay, everything that they should have done on the 6th of January, they trust me, they've covered all bases now. They've extended the evening outer perimeter for blocks, and I think right now it's almost like a police state when you look at how the security is right now at this point in time. So no. Nobody's people, if they don't know who you are, you're not going to be able to get near that place. So they've got so much security right now. Fences up, barriers, outer barriers, they've extended it. And right now, no. That on the 20th of January, it's going to be an inauguration. And they're not even talking about even taking it inside. But right now, it's definitely very secure. And I've had a chance to look at it. Because I'm in that area, I've had a chance to go up in. I'm telling you, the place is secure, pretty secure.
So what do you think happened, Marshal Fogg, back on January 6th then?
Well, January 6th, obviously, everybody's asking that question. I mean, why was security so lax? I mean, I've done a lot of these, what you call protection details, and where we've had security and we've had information. There was a lot of information out that on the 6th was supposed to be a takeover, a coup. I mean, this was what I was hearing way before the 6th. So FBI, Capitol Police, everybody had this information. Now, why did they stand down? Those are the questions that are being asked. Was there a conspiracy? You got one congresswoman. She's saying that she actually saw other congresspeople bringing some of these folks into the Capitol, showing them around the day before. And it was strange.
Time has gotten better, so I want to thank you both for joining us on the program. Wilmer Leon from Washington, D.C., and Matthew Fogg from Washington, D.C. as well. Thank you both, and have a great year. Welcome back, everyone. The Pentagon has warned of an increase in far-right and white supremacist extremism in the U.S. military over the past year. An unnamed senior military official said radical groups are actively recruiting U.S. military personnel into their cause. The official added extremist groups are also encouraging their members to join armed forces to acquire skills and experience. Active duty service members and veterans, as well as police officers, were among the U.S. president's supporters who stormed the Capitol last week. The Pentagon says it will launch a probe into the extent of extremism in the U.S. military ranks. This after 14 senators call for alarming trend to be immediately addressed. New York State Attorney General has brought a suit against New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio and the police commissioner over allegations of police violence. Federal lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court of Manhattan alleges New York police used excessive force against racial justice protesters in May 2019. Suit alleges that law enforcement officers violated protesters' rights by making mass arrests, often without probable cause. In separate statements, de Blasio and the police chief said they supported major police reforms but opposed this legal action. Death of African-American George Floyd at the hands of a white cop back in May 2019 sparked waves of anti-racism protests throughout America. The U.S. Labor Department says the number of Americans filing new claims for unemployment has jumped to nearly a million in the first week of 2021. The department says the figure shows a rise of nearly 200,000 compared with the previous week. Now, this is the biggest increase since the beginning of the coronavirus in the U.S. back in March. Data is far worse than what analysts had expected. This comes as the world's largest economy continues to reel
from a recent spike in infections. The number of COVID cases in the U.S. has exceeded 23 million, with over 384,000 deaths. The U.S. has already started its vaccination program. Colin Campbell earlier joined us from Chicago with a breakdown of the COVID-related challenges the U.S. is grappling with.
There are still people dying every day, several every minute. And this is a very big situation in the U.S. because of the fact that we've never really gotten a grip on the COVID-19 situation. We thought we saw a dip earlier in 2020, where we saw it sort of decline a little bit, but then it spiked way up because people got too relaxed and they did not believe the science. And then we had an administration that did not adhere by the science and did not listen to health officials, and also believed that they knew the best way to go forward without any clear plan. It is now 2021. And we still don't have a clear plan as to how the vaccine should be rolled out across America. There are states that have their own jurisdictions, their own reasons, and their own methods for administering the vaccine. But as far as a large, widespread federal policy, we still don't have one.
The UN has strongly condemned the U.S. decision to designate Yemen's Ansar the Movement as a terrorist group.
We are struggling now without the designation. With the designation, it's going to be catastrophic. It literally is going to be a death sentence to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of innocent people in Yemen. In my opinion,
the Gulf states need to pick up... The World Food Program chief made the remarks during a UN Security Council briefing where he urged Washington to reverse its decision. Also, UN's Yemen envoy, Martin Griffiths, said the designation will have a chilling effect on the peace process in the country. World Body's aid chief, Mark Lowcock, also urged Washington to reverse course, warning the designation will bring about a famine unprecedented in four decades. On Sunday, Washington blacklisted the Ansarullah movement, which controls all of northern Yemen. Decision, which takes effect on the 19th of January, has drawn criticism from the international community, including the European Union. A senior leader of Iraq's popular mobilization units has condemned Washington's blacklisting of the group's deputy commander, Abu Fadak al-Muhammadawi. Fali al-Fayed, who himself was blacklisted by the U.S. just days ago, said that Washington's move amounts to a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. Fayed added that measure also ignores the Iraqi government and official institutions, as well as decisions made by the Iraqi parliament. He also stressed it will be unacceptable to put those who fight terrorists and attack theory groups on a terror list. This comes as Baghdad has already condemned the blacklisting of al-Fayed, who's repeatedly called for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq. The Popular Mobilization Units is an official legal organization which operates under the command of the Iraqi Armed Forces. The Turkish defense minister says Ankara will not turn back on its deal for Russian S-400 missile defense systems despite opposition out of the U.S. Hulusi Akar said annulling the contract on the S-400 import will be very problematic. However, he expressed hope that a dispute with the U.S. on the issue could be resolved through dialogue. He also called on Washington to distance itself from threatening language such as sanctions. Washington slapped sanctions on Turkey last month following its acquisition of the S-400s. U.S. says the Russian missile systems pose a threat to its F-35 fighter jets, part Antonov's broader defense systems. Turkey, though, rejects that and says S-400s will not even be integrated into NATO systems. And political commentator Hatem Yavuz says Turkey is trying to become militarily independent of the U.S. by purchasing the S-400 missile systems from Russia, as well as developing its own defensive technology.
Turkey had to weigh its balance and said, hey, if the Americans are going to give out thousands of truckloads of armory to their to their allies' enemy, which is the YPG, PKK, whatever you want to call those alphabets, what's going to happen in the next few years if they attack us? So if we used an American system now, today, it won't probably work on Turkish on the Turkish soil. So for that reason, Turkey had to be more independent and receive information technology transfer from the Russians under the S-400 program. So it's not just the machinery itself of the $2.4 billion purchase, it's the technology transfer. Turkey has been staunch to develop its own systems integrated to with its S-400 together, not a NATO ally system. And this will go on. This will go on for the next term of presidency of Biden, arguing don't set up the S-400s. Well, Turkey has set up the S-400s. Like it or not, Turkey has to take and control its own security and its own interest.
Turkey and Greece have set date for talks now, which may break a five-year impasse over maritime boundaries and offshore energy resources. EU has taken Athens' side in this dispute, drawing up a list of sanctions against Turkey, a move Ankara has labeled as strategic blindness. Here's Bianca Rahimi with your story.
Turkey has the longest continental coastline in the eastern Mediterranean and rejects the maritime boundary claims of Greece and the Greek Cypriot administration in the region. Ankara says these claims are excessive and violate the sovereign rights of both Turkey and Turkish Cypriots. The EU decided on punitive measures against Turkey last year after Ankara asserted its rights in the region by sending several drill ships to explore for energy on its continental shelf. However, the implementation of sanctions has been postponed until March, and Turkey says it is ready to get its relationship with the EU back on track in 2021.
We are inviting Greece, which has been increasing its airspace violations and unlawful activities in islands that are demilitarized, to give up their actions that are raising tensions. I believe that the exploratory talks with our neighbor Greece, which will start on the 25th of January, will, God willing, herald a new period.
European diplomats have signaled the dispute between Turkey and Greece is of paramount importance and also that progress has already been made.
What I have felt from my discussion with the minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu is progress has been made too, both in the way of relations between Turkey and Greece and in relations between Turkey and Cyprus and in relations between Turkey and France, to give you some examples.
Another issue high on the agenda for talks is Turkey's EU membership bid. Negotiations began in 2005, but have since come to a standstill. Erdogan says Turkey's membership will be a good thing for the EU, now Britain has left the bloc.
Uncertainties that are increasing with Brexit can only be dissipated with Turkey receiving its rightful place in the European family. We, as a country, are ready to put our relations back on track and create positive agendas with a long-term perspective.
In recent talks, Turkey has been quick to remind the EU of its dependence on Ankara when it comes to preventing hundreds of thousands of refugees and migrants from trying to cross into European nations. Turkey says by taking initiatives in places like Syria and Libya, it is contributing to the EU's security considerably and is calling on the bloc not to allow disputes with individual members like Greece and France to jeopardize that. Bianca Rahimi, London.
North Korea has displayed a submarine-launched ballistic missile at a military parade in the capital, Pyongyang. Missile was showcased as part of celebrations to mark the inauguration of the 8th Congress of the Ruling Workers' Party. Parade also included the march of the Republic's elite units and rockets, which North Korean media described as having powerful striking capabilities for thoroughly annihilating enemies outside the territory. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un addressed the assembly and decried the U.S. as the foremost principal enemy of his country. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
There are no charges pending against Julian Assange in the UK. A UK judge denied the US request to extradite him, the only place where charges are pending. Despite this, the judge just ruled he must remain imprisoned in a COVID-ridden high-security prison while the US appeals, said Glenn Greenwald, journalist. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading Journalist and Activist Condemn UK Decision to Keep Assange Locked Up Without Charge. Here's the details of this article. United Kingdom court has ruled that WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange must remain in prison, despite an earlier ruling that he could not be extradited to the United States. Explaining her decision, District Judge Vanessa Baritzer said that, as far as Mr. Assange is concerned, this case has not been won, adding that the United States must be allowed to appeal her earlier decision. Part of the ruling was based upon her assessment of the Australian publisher being a serious flight risk if released, noting he had huge support networks that could help him should he again choose to go to the ground. The court's decision was immediately panned by journalists and press freedom organizations who had hoped to see Assange released recently after 7 years in prison and hiding in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. To us, that is nothing more than a pretext to keep him detained. This seems unnecessarily punitive at adding insult to injury after the 10 years of hell that he has endured. We are deeply disappointed with today's decision, said Rebecca Vincent, Reporters Without Borders Director of International Campaigns, outside the courtroom. Vincent had been denied entry to the courtroom, as had some of Assange's relatives. She had also faced questioning and harassment from police, who used their new powers under the UK's lockdown law to break up pro-Assange demonstrations, even arresting a 92-year-old man. Assange lawyer Edward Fitzgerald QC expressed his disappointment at the news that his client would be heading back to Belmarsh Prison in South London. The logical outcome of the ruling would be he gains liberty at least conditionally, he stated. Assange colleagues in alternative media were also quick to condemn Baritzer's ruling. The judge's decision against bailing Assange only fuels the theory that this prosecution is about keeping a publisher who the US government despises tied up and in limbo so he cannot effectively challenge them ever again, said Kevin Castola. This is absolutely outrageous for the judge to deny Assange bail and to claim that Belmarsh is doing a fine job of handling COVID, even while London is on lockdown. There are no charges pending against Julian Assange in the UK. A UK judge denied the US request to extradite him, the only place where charges are pending. Despite this, the judge just ruled he must remain imprisoned in a COVID-ridden high-security prison while the US appeals, added Glenn Greenwald, journalist. This shows how authoritarian the British judiciary is. The only thing the US cares about is keeping Assange in a cage. Silence and disappeared. This gives them the best of all worlds. He stays in prison with no need to prove he's guilty of anything. That's despotic. A particularly high security prison, HMP Belmarsh, is generally considered the UK's most notorious jail, taking in prisoners from around the country that other prisons cannot handle. The government's 2019 report on conditions inside the facility noted it was overrun with 120 violent gangs, and that there were 161 recorded inmate assaults on staff. After a COVID-19 outbreak this year, inmates have been largely locked down in their cells, typically for 23 hours a day. Barrister ruled that Assange would not be sent to the United States as she was not convinced that the U.S. prison system could guarantee he would not commit suicide while incarcerated. The publisher faced up to 175 years in prison for his alleged breach of Espionage Act of 1917, while receiving classified information from U.S. soldier Chelsea Manning. However, she sided with the United States on both their assertions and the legality of their claims, setting a precedent that some called a chilling ruling for investigative journalism. WikiLeaks disseminated Manning's information, which came to be known as the Iraq War Logs. Perhaps the most explosive revelation was a recording of a U.S. helicopter attack on central Baghdad in July 2007. The video shows American personnel massacring at least a dozen Iraqi civilians, including two Reuters journalists, in cold blood. The images went viral on social media and showed a completely different sight to the occupation than the carefully sanitized one the U.S. military had been fastidiously curating. From 2013 to 2019, Assange was confined to the Ecuadorian embassy in London, unable to travel to the country that had offered him political asylum. However, keen to curry favor with Washington, new President Lenin Moreno allowed British authorities to enter the building and arrest him. Since then, he has been housed in Belmarsh. This new ruling prolongs his stay. But if the appeal is unsuccessful, the UK will no longer have any legal argument to keep him interned. Perhaps there is light at the end of the tunnel for the Australian.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahil aliyyil azim. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyyina Abil Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. We were discussing some of the main features of the community of Ahlul Bayt عليهم السلام, and I talked last night about truthfulness, and I believe that this is a very important quality of a mu'min and also a Muslim community. Inshallah, I hope by the discussion that we have tonight, it will become crystal clear that truthfulness is very fundamental. It's not like some, for example, other qualities that are necessary, but even without them, you can still say, I am a mu'min, but not a good mu'min. No, without truthfulness, it's very difficult to be counted as mu'min. Now, I want to start a Quranic discussion here about haqq, and inshallah, I mentioned some of the major points. It's such a broad concept and such a far-reaching concept in the Quran. Everything starts and ends with haqq in the Quran. In my understanding, this is the meaning of ubudiyyah, to be at the service of truth. Therefore, sometimes you find people who have no history of Islam, no history of ibadah, but they have this quality of truthfulness. They are very close to Islam. And when they become Muslim, they are among the best. Look at Abu Zar. Abu Zar was a mushrik. He was not a believer in God in a monotheistic way. He was a mushrik. But Abu Zar had a quality which was very important. Of course, he had many good qualities, but the one which is very important and mentioned in our hadith is he was very truthful, very honest. He never told lies in his life. Even Rasulullah said, a sky has not provided shadow on anyone who is more honest in his speech than Abu Zar. He was never telling lies. Even it is said, the night that Rasulullah was leaving Mecca for Medina, and you know, pagans were around the house of Rasulullah, and they were, you know, ready to find Rasulullah and kill Rasulullah. So Abu Zar was taking Rasulullah undercover outside Mecca. So he had put something on Rasulullah, some dress or something. So few of mushrikeen saw Abu Zar. What are you carrying? He said, I'm carrying Rasulullah. He didn't tell lies. He said, I'm carrying Rasulullah. They said, oh, he's joking. If he was carrying Rasulullah, he was not saying. So he was such an honest person. I'm not saying this level of, you know, telling the truth is always necessary. Because sometimes you, as I said yesterday, maybe you have to use different words, you know, some maneuver not to tell the truth, but not to tell lies. That's another issue. But he was such an honest person. He was not aware of all these, you know, techniques and, you know, loopholes that we are using. He was always saying truth. When Abu Zar became a Muslim, how many years it took him to become a close companion of Rasulullah? From the first day he was a special. Because from the first day he entered Islam through the gate of truthfulness. And this is a quality of muttaqin, siddiqin, So it didn't take him that long.
Oh, what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow. His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. Down this road that holds all the answers. Open your heart to something greater. His holy book speaks pure and true, and always tells us what we must do. His last prophet was sent as a guide, an example by which we abide. There is salvation for those who seek to find the one and only source of peace and understanding of why we are here. Who created us, who we must fear. So what a wonderful world this would be if we all open our eyes to see. He is all that we need right now, and we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Salman is another example. Did Salman need to pray and fast and go for Hajj for 20, 30, 40 years till he becomes a special? He joined Rasulullah in Medina. The maximum he was with Rasulullah was 10 years. But even he didn't need 10 years to become a special. From the beginning he was a special. Why? Because he was a person who served his life for finding the truth. First, he left his very rich family background. He looked for Christianity. After Christianity, he heard about Prophet of Akhir al-Zaman. He moved to Medina because he knew that he is going to be there. This man has served his life at the service of truth. Then it just needs a little surgery to connect him to Quran, to connect him to Rasulullah. That's enough. Because he's already committed to Haq. Just you need to show him that today this man represents Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This man is the Hujjah of Allah. That's enough. But many people spend their life under the banner of Islam, but they never become like Abu Zar or Salman. Because they enter into Islam through rituals, through actions, not through sidq, not through haq. This is the problem. So you see, this man is, I don't know, 40, 50, 60 years old, still tells lies. His salat is on time, his hajj is okay, his ziyarah is okay, but he tells lies. So he has missed the point. What have you been doing all these years? He cheats, or she cheats. This is not mu'min. The whole point of praying, fasting, going for hajj, going for ziyarah, doing charity, doing voluntary work is all to learn that we should serve haq. We should serve Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, who is haq. And then gradually we ourselves become sign of truth for other people, so that people, by listening to me, by looking at me, can understand haq. This is what we have to achieve.
That was The Characters of Shia Community by Hujjatul Islam, Dr. Shomali, in the program The Spiritual Message of Islam.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
Oh Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. Oh Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif. Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. O Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. O Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic is racking up mind-blowing bills, trillions of dollars in lost tax revenues, ramped-up spending, and new borrowing set to burden the next generation with record levels of debt. In the direst of cases, low- and middle-income countries, mostly in Africa and Latin America, that are already saddled with back-breaking debt, covering the rising costs is transforming into a high-stakes test of national solvency. We now present you an article written jointly by Alexander Villegas and Anthony Fayola and Leslie Roughton. The piece is titled, As Spending Climbs and Revenue Falls, Coronavirus Forces a Global Reckoning. The article has been taken from the Washington Post. Costa Rica built Latin America's model society, enacting universal health care, and spending its way to one of the Western Hemisphere's highest literacy rates. But now, it's reeling from financially crushing side effects of the coronavirus, as cratering revenues and crisis spending forces a reckoning over a massive pile of government debt. The coronavirus pandemic is hurtling heavily leveraged nations into an economic danger zone, threatening to bankrupt the worst affected. Costa Rica, a country known for ziplining tourists and American retirees, is scrambling to stave off a full-blown debt crisis, imposing emergency cuts and proposing harsher measures that touched off rare violent protests last autumn. To keep the lights on, a progressive, eco-friendly nation is weighing desperate solutions, including open-pit gold mining, even oceanic fracking. Around the globe, the coronavirus pandemic is racking up mind-blowing bills, trillions of dollars in lost tax revenues, ramped-up spending and new borrowing set to burden the next generation with record levels of debt. In the direst of cases, low- and middle-income countries, mostly in Africa and Latin America, that are already saddled with back-breaking debt, covering the rising costs, is transforming into a high-stakes test of national solvency. Analysts call it a debt tsunami. National accounts are sinking into the red at a record level. According to the Institute of International Finance, by the end of 2020, total government debt worldwide was projected to soar by $9 trillion and top 103% of global gross domestic product or GDP, a historic jump of more than 10 percentage points in just 1 year. Countries have maxed out their figurative credit cards to buy medical equipment, set up field hospitals, deployed healthcare workers and sourced vaccines, even as pandemic-related recessions have caused tax revenues to plunge and aid for the unemployed to spike. Countries that rely on tourism, which has ground to a virtual halt, or commodities like oil that have sunk in price, have felt the sting most keenly. The United States itself has run up debt at a pace not seen since the Second World War. But the world's wealthy nations are supposedly better able to cope with the growing debt than their poorer counterparts. Angola, for example, effectively shut out of global markets, is racing to strike a deal with the Chinese, but even that might not be enough to prevent a painful debt crisis. Sri Lanka, locked in recession, needs to make $4 billion in debt payments this year with only $6 billion in the bank. Brazil's debt, worsened by a yawning budget deficit, has surged to a crippling 95% of the gross domestic product GDP, raising alarm over the medium-term ability of the Latin American giant to stay afloat. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have sought to aid the most vulnerable countries, and the world's wealthiest nations endorsed a plan in October to extend the suspension of debt payments owed to them by the poorest countries. In November, those nations additionally agreed to jointly work towards some form of debt relief for the poorest nations that seek it from them, and also encourage private lenders to follow suit. But analysts say that may not be enough. According to the International Monetary Fund, 38 low-income countries are either in debt distress or at high risk of falling into it. Unless private creditors and wealthy nations set up and agree to concessions or outright debt forgiveness, the pandemic's fiscal shock could hurl some of those, as well as highly leveraged middle-income countries such as Costa Rica, towards catastrophic national bankruptcies. analysts argue that the need for stimulus to keep economies running during this historically challenging period still outweighs the need to balance budgets. Even the International Monetary Fund, the global guardian of fiscal rectitude, is telling countries that now is not the time to scrimp, lest they jeopardize still fragile economic recoveries. Yet, even if a repeat of the cascading financial crises seen in Latin America and Asia in the 1980s and 1990s is avoided, the debt surge threatens to linger as a millstone around the necks of nations for years. It will compromise their ability to fight the first global increase in extreme poverty since the 1990s, and to invest in infrastructure projects such as education and innovation down the line. Zambia, once a shining example of Africa's economic renaissance, is now the ghost of crisis future for debt-burdened countries slammed by the coronavirus pandemic. The sub-Saharan African nation fell into default in November, a result of its high reliance on foreign debt, a pandemic blow to the price of copper, its main commodity, and one of its worst droughts in 40 years. The country is now printing money to survive, forcing a devaluation of its currency, kwacha, and creating spiraling inflation that's spreading misery at the worst possible time. At the government's cancer disease hospital in Lusaka, the capital of Zambia, doctors say the price of imported drug treatments have doubled. According to a household survey in July, a third of the country's workers have lost their wages, 39% were skipping a meal, and 67% are worried about not having enough food to eat. Sakala Zulu, a 26-year-old teacher from eastern Zambia, said staple foods such as eggs and sugar now cost 60% more than just 3 months ago, making it harder to feed his six children. The cost of transport for the 12-mile commute to and from work has risen by 20%. Sakala Zulu said, "Right now, I feel there is no part of my life not affected." Zambia is seeking to restructure its debt, but private creditors have shown little willingness to budge. A move to renegotiate substantial loans from China has been cloaked in secrecy. As things stand, more than half of the government's spending this year is earmarked for servicing debt alone, leaving little for social programs and spending on healthcare and education. Ishmael Zulu of the advocacy group Cuts International said, "What you see now on the ground is reduced spending on key social sectors," he added. "With the high levels of poverty in Zambia, there are many people that are heavily reliant on government programs. These programs are suffering at the cost of increased debt levels. Hospitals that are in small districts and the far-flung areas of the country are suffering at the cost of increased debt servicing." Half a world away, Costa Rica is scrambling to avoid a similar fate. When the pandemic hit, tourism, the country's economic lifeblood, dried up and unemployment skyrocketed to more than 24%, draining state coffers of healthcare contributions just as the Costa Rican government was struggling to respond to the coronavirus pandemic. A tax break for hard-hit businesses and financial aid to out-of-work Costa Ricans dug the fiscal hole deeper. The ensuing cash crunch forced hard decisions for the government, including emergency cuts. At El Jardin Elementary School in northern Costa Rica, Principal Elizabeth Mejia says the operating budget was slashed in half. Teachers are buying their own printers, ink cartridges, and paper to distribute assignments to students. School Principal Elizabeth Mejia said she's been told by the government to hold fundraisers to cover maintenance costs. "They tell us that if we need to fix something, that we should go and sell our assets." In the years after the Great Recession of 2008, Costa Rica ran up deficits and debt to sustain expansive state payrolls and progressive policies. 2 years ago, the government attempted what economists describe as a fiscal band-aid, a new value-added tax, VAT, and limits on salary increases for state workers. Those measures paled in comparison with proposal last year when the government of President Carlos Alvarado Quesada, seeking to boost its bid for a $1.75 billion IMF bailout, sought broad tax increases in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic. Protesters hit the streets of Costa Rica, blocking intersections nationwide, clashing with police officers and slowing commerce in a country that had only recently come out of lockdown. Gerardo Zuniaga, an activist who joined the protests with a mask on his face, said, "People don't have money to pay their debts. Businesses don't have money to pay for supplies, their employees, their permits, and all the social contributions." Gerardo Zuniaga said, "We understand that there has to be some agreement with the International Monetary Fund, but what we don't agree with are items where the most vulnerable people are harmed." The Costa Rican government backed off that proposal and is now in talks with the opposition, unions, civic activists, and industrial groups to find a more palatable solution. But to avoid a painful default like the one the country suffered in 1981, when runaway inflation and spikes in poverty sparked a lost decade, something's got to give. With tourism not expected to recover fully for many years, politicians and businesses are pushing sources of revenue that run afoul of Costa Rica's renowned environmentalism. They include open-pit gold mining, effectively an ecological trade-off for what supporters estimate would be 6,500 direct and indirect jobs and a $9.52 billion jolt for the economy. In August, lawmakers pushed another controversial option, opening Costa Rica lands and shorelines to fracking and oil drilling. Costa Rican lawmaker Patricia Villegas said during a congressional debate, "Our marine territory is 10 times larger than our landmass, and we know little about its riches," she added. "We have sources of energy that we exploit, like hydroelectric energy, wind energy, geothermal, and solar, but we haven't wanted to discuss the possibility of taking advantage of gas and oil." Costa Rica is sitting on a gold mine. In a country that pledged to rely entirely on renewable energy sources by 2030, the debt debate is pitting the country's economic future against cherished environmental ideals and goals. Activists and the government say any boost in oil and natural gas exploration runs counter to everything the country has worked for. They say the nation must find other ways. Elian Villegas, Costa Rica's finance minister, said, "We've launched a decarbonization plan to the world, and those things are fundamental to us as a nation, not just cosmetic." He added, "I find those solutions to be very distant from the essence of being a Costa Rican."
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.